And it's KVC Arts Now on KVCR, Arts and Entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. On this edition of the program, music from and conversation with Andy Timmons. Andy was on the program 3 years ago talking about his news release at the time, Electric Truth. Music from that behind us now, as well as sharing a really cool story involving Steve Vai. Now, on this edition of the program, we'll hear about his latest release called Recovery, just out. We'll also hear about a piece he had written with Peter Frampton in mind, and then Frampton ended up playing on it. That's coming up in about 2 minutes or so. First, though, asking for a bit of indulgence with the first 2 minutes as I made a connection, I think I was slow to make this connection, between Andy and Louisville, Kentucky. This is tied in and has nothing to do with any of the interview, but I read or heard somewhere that a lot of your early listening, I think somebody was like, so what were your influences, Andy? And I think you said you had a brother, maybe about 10 years older. And so being a Kentucky guy, I have to ask, is your brother the guy who gave us Ear Ecstasy in Louisville?
Absolutely. So, yeah, that's my brother, John Timmons.
Oh, good God.
So he's 8 years my elder, but I have another brother, Mark, who's 12 years my elder. So, you know, I was born in 1963, and so he was the perfect record-buying age. And then my brother John would have been 8 and coming up right behind him. So all the 60s output, you know, all the British invasion stuff, they were buying in real time. So that's still to this day my foundation and some of my fondest music that I still go back to. You know, all the Dave Clark Five and Beatles, Kinks, Yardbirds, a few others, you know.
Oh, wow.
All my brothers were very big in music fans, and they each dabbled a bit in music, you know, guitar and drums and whatnot. But John obviously went down the path of retail. He just was an avid collector and had such a large collection. At some point, he decided maybe he should open up a shop because he didn't have enough room for his collection anymore. That's how the original Ear Ecstasy was born. How many years ago? That's been over 30 years, maybe 40 years ago.
Well, I grew up in Murray, and I went over to Louisville, and the stop that you would just have to make, Electric Ladyland, and then over to Ear Ecstasy, those were just, you know, you had to do that on Bardstown Road.
Yeah, it was truly, I mean, I'm a bit of a record store aficionado, and that's one of the things I'd look up in every city I was in, find the local record shops and see the treasures. And his was always one of the best in the world. It really was. Certainly biased on my end, but I think a lot of other people would agree. He just really had curated and cultivated a great culture there. It's sad that it's no longer there, but they had a great run.
Oh, absolutely.
Very proud of him for what he did there.
Oh, truly. Let's go into Boy from Beckenham. It's a tribute to Peter Frampton in mind, but then Frampton ended up joining you on this. So I've read and I've listened to you tell the story, but for my listeners, please talk about this time, the formation of the tune, and then later after the fact.
It's an interesting little trajectory that the song had. I was a big Peter fan, again, thanks to my brother John of Ear Ecstasy fame. He bought all the Frampton stuff from Frampton's Camel, even Humble Pie Forward.
Mm.
All the albums leading up to the huge Frampton Comes Alive was already, you know, in my ear, and I've been hearing my brother play the stuff all the time. So I was already a big fan. And then Frampton Comes Alive comes out, and just love that record so much. And, you know, I recognize that throughout my career that there's certain things, the way he writes, the way he plays guitar, some of those things I had taken a bit of that, you know. He was part of my foundation for sure. Years later, my drummer, Dan Wojciechowski, he was in the Andy Timmons band with me, but also when I was with Olivia Newton-John, he was my drummer in that group. Well, then he got the opportunity to play with Peter Frampton, so then he became Peter Frampton's drummer, and still is to this day. That dates back to probably 2007. So over the years after that, I would have an opportunity to go see my great buddy playing with one of my heroes, Peter, you know. And so fast forward to 2019, before the pandemic and before Peter's muscular condition started taking hold, he did a show in Texas and I went out to see them and was so blown away by the night of music and how great Peter was still singing and playing. And I had an idea for a song that became The Boy from Beckenham. And I just had this riff and this tune Well, it sat for a while. My band never recorded it, but I had a nice demo of it in my little home studio. And I got an offer to do a recording workshop at the great Sweetwater facilities up in Fort Wayne, Indiana. They said, hey, we'd like you to come teach a course on recording. And the benefit for you is bring in a couple of songs. Either bring your own band or use the house band, and you can just record some music and then take it with you and do what you'd like. So one of the tunes I had in my pocket was Boy from Beckenham, dedicated to Peter. Why don't I just record that? It's a good song. That was one of the two songs I recorded. It turned out really nice, but I didn't record the solo. And it was just kind of sitting. I didn't really have a purpose for it. It was just something I wanted to record. And then it was now a couple years later, so it would have been my birthday of 2023. Now the pandemic has loosened up and Peter's out performing. Now he's sitting down when he performs now because of his myotisis disease that he's battling, quite heroically, I might add. And he played a three-hour show, just incredible, still playing great, everything going for it, 1,000%. It was so inspiring. And with all his obstacles, you would never know there was any issue. Aside from that, he's sitting while he's performing. In the back of my mind, I'm going, how cool would it be if Peter would play on it? But at the same time, I'm like, I know I'll see him after the show. I don't want to burden this guy with something to do when he's got plenty on his plate. But I thought, you know, it's now or never. And this is in New York, but I should point out, my wife and I were trying to think of something cool to do for my birthday. July 26, 2023. We couldn't decide on any vacation destination. So she just said, well, just find a concert somewhere that you want to go to and we'll go. And there I found Peter was playing in Long Island. We love going to Manhattan. So let's just go to New York for the weekend and see Peter. So there I am backstage. You know, he's performed this very long show. I don't want to burden him. But I mentioned the song to him. I said, man, would you possibly consider playing on it without missing a beat? He said, of course, I'd love to, And I sent him the song the next day, and he loves the tune. He says, I'll work on it, and I'll get back to you. You know, maybe weeks or maybe even a couple of months had gone by, and I'm not going to be the guy to be pesky. Hey, are you working on the track? I just thought, in his own time, if he feels up to it.
Yeah.
Well, he finally reaches back to me and says, hey, look, don't be concerned, but I'm working on it every day.
Wow.
And I go, Peter, I don't want this to be a burden in any way. He goes, no, this is exactly what I need. So, and I knew exactly what he meant in that he probably enjoyed having, and I'm sure he had other things too, but he enjoyed having a project to be working on to keep his playing going with the disease that he's battling. And, one day that could be taken away from him. So when he finally sent the solo that he'd recorded, I was just over the moon because it was every hallmark of what makes him so great. Just his note choice, his tone, the melodic direction of the arc of the solo was just so great. Then it came time to, these days, songs don't exist unless you have a video of you playing it, So he graciously agreed to record his solo video at his house. His keyboard player, Rob Hunt, is a great videographer as well. So they record this great version of Peter playing the solo. Then I'll do my track at the house. And his video looked so good. Mine looked okay. But I thought, how cool would it be to have like a montage of his whole career playing as I'm playing this tune dedicated to him, and then he pops on the screen. So Rob Arthur, the same guy that did the video of Peter, offered, we'll put this video together. Let's see about getting the material. Well, we thought we had the rights to all this video and whatnot, but that was not the case. He had done an edit of the video, but the live footage of him playing The Village on the Green, which was a Bill Graham production out in San Francisco, that company owned the footage, not Peter. Long story short, it wasn't cheap, but I thought, I got to have that footage in there. It's just too great. It was just one of those, just for the sake of doing something fun and cool, didn't matter about what it was going to cost, or there was no financial gain to be had. The only gain, which was huge for me, was just the amazing gratification of having this tune that I could collaborate with one of my heroes on, and that's The Boy from Beckenham, and I couldn't be more thrilled with the way the whole thing turned out. And so what a cool thing, you know, for a little fan from Evansville.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. The video that you mentioned, when people see this, and I really encourage it because it's just a beautiful series of moments, it's pretty much you playing, and then there's the slideshow. We've got Peter in the background or off to the side, solo stuff, Humble Pie, him standing next to Les Paul. Then at the end, wonderful, he and you standing together.
Just, and that was the moment that I asked him to play. We had other pictures we'd taken over the years, but that was the exact moment where I'd asked him to play on the record.
Oh, wow.
So, kind of nice that got captured, right? You
know? Yeah. Now I have to go look at it again just for that one picture. Oh, that's really cool. You've spoken about what Frampton does, you know, what's different or atypical at least,
sure.
You know, so what makes it special.
Mm-hmm.
But when you were talking about that, one, you're holding a guitar. But the other thing is, the words that you're using are things like descending 2-5 sequences, A minor to D7, the 13-9.
Yeah.
Can you put that in terms that most people can understand without having theory?
Well, there's a good bit of jazz in what Peter does. So when I wrote the solo section that I was intending just for me to play over it and sound like Peter, that he ended up playing over, I knew he would love it, because he'd use certain devices like that. And it's just a particular set of chords, regardless of what numbers or theory you give them, A minor to D7, G minor to C7, to F, you know. It's a particular sound and feel and vibe that comes with that. Now, Peter would have learned some of that from studying some jazz. I know he was into Django Reinhardt at a certain point. I'm sure he loves Wes as well, as we all do.
Yeah.
Wes Montgomery. So that's part of his thing that sets him apart. But there's some things that are kind of undefinable. There's a way that an artist develops, the way they hear melody and the way they hear melodies over certain chords can be very unique to them. And Peter has that. He's a very unique voice, voice meaning either singing or playing guitar. The way he conceives of melodies is very particular to him. And that's not something you can put into theory, but it's something that I had to come up with a term when I was teaching a course about where melody comes from. And the term I came up with is called aurelect. Instead of the intellect, you can intellectualize all things, you know, music and whatever. But there's also things that are just more of emotion and instinct that could be considered intellect. But I decided to call it the aurelect as it relates to the way an artist hears music and the way they communicate it thusly. And it's just a combination of all the things that they've taken in that they've loved musically, that they learn either subconsciously or very consciously. You know, the Beatles, you know, Lennon and McCartney had incredible melodic instincts, but it's not like they knew what they were doing. They just learned a lot of songs. And it kind of gave them a springboard that, you know, not that they were plagiarizing everything, but you start to develop these instincts based on what you love, and you kind of distill it in your own way. So David Bowie talked wonderfully about it, calling himself a collector. Somebody tried to compliment him on being this trendsetter and, you know, all these this breakthrough. He said, no, I'm a collector. I'm just taking these things that I love, you know. There was glam before Ziggy, but he put it together in his own way. There was blues rock before Stevie Ray, but he took Albert King and Jimi Hendrix and just did it his own way, you know. So that's kind of Peter in a nutshell as well. He's just taking all these different influences and a bit more jazz than your typical pop rock artist, you know, and it just gave him a unique sense of harmony and melodic direction. It's just his footprint. It's his DNA.
Nice. Kind of a sidebar, but when you did the Sgt. Pepper's album, because some of your playing, I mean, actually mimics the tone of McCartney or Ringo, or whether they're doing a solo or harmonizing.
Yeah.
So that was really cool, something I picked up on. But as you were playing it and feeling it and getting things with your mind's eye, could there have been a point when you might have been picturing and channeling not the Beatles, but Frampton backed by the Bee Gees?
I assure you, that never entered my mind. And sadly or not, I have still yet to see that particular picture.
Oh, don't do it.
I mean, well, that's the thing, that there's been so much negative association. I can't imagine on some level that historically it must be valuable to go back and see, but I also know that maybe nobody wants me to do that. I don't know. It's just, you know, even if something was even okay, some things don't hold up, and I'm afraid that might be. It's like when I sat and watched Xanadu with my wife. And we're lifelong, you know, fans of Olivia and friends with Olivia. Now, Grease holds up all day long for decades and forever, for eternity. But, not so much Xanadu.
No.
It's a great moment in time, you know. She just looks so beautiful, and that's amazing music in there. But, yeah, I would say Sigmund the Sea Monster doesn't hold up either. But she was great when I was a kid, but not so much today.
With Xanadu, I will go down until the end of time defending the section with the tubes and the Glenn Miller Orchestra mashup section.
Well, we used to do that. There was a period where Olivia and I and the band would tour and play with local symphonies in each city. So she thought, wouldn't it be great to do that song, Dancing, the one you're talking about?
Oh, my God.
It mixes Andrew Sisters and the Tubes Rock and Roll. So we did it with the Sydney Symphony at the Sydney Opera House. And it's on DVD. You can find this, man.
Oh.
So it's out there. And I'm the one singing Fee Wabel's parts.
Oh, wow.
I was not really up for it, but I did my best. So, yeah, you can find that. That's a nice arrangement. The Andrew Sisters part in particular I thought was really, really good.
It's truly, truly incredible. And I may actually go back to watch the Frampton Bee Gees thing. I mean, even though it's right up there with Kiss meets the Phantom of the Park. You know, it's...
yeah. That's a good analogy. And that, I've seen bits of that, but I was a huge Kiss fan. But by the time that came out, I had moved on. Like after Alive 2 is where I started to kind of drift into other things. They were the perfect group for me at the age I was, and what I learned, and how I, you know, that's how I learned how to play guitar was from Ace Frehley.
I'm David Fleming in conversation with Andy Timmons, kind of dancing around the Beatles, Peter Frampton, and somehow even Kiss meets the Phantom of the Park, taking a look at his 2025 release, Recovery, as KBC Arts continues. And this one starts with Elegy for Jeff. Elegy for Jeff. Now, when I hear a title like this, I always go straight to Jeff Porcaro, but this one is Jeff Beck.
Oh, yeah.
And so many titles come after the fact, but I think here you knew you were going to create an elegy for Jeff, and so there it was.
Yeah, it was a shock, and I do love Jeff Porcaro, although I've never written a tribute to him. Between he and Ringo Starr, there was two drummers that I always wanted to play with. To this point, neither have happened, but you never know. I just love the way Jeff and Steve Lukather being one of my biggest influences, of course.
Yeah.
The way that they click together. But yeah, Jeff Beck, of course, is just a lifelong hero. Again, thanks to my older brothers, all the Yardbirds records, in particular the greatest hits with Shapes of Things on it, was a big part of my earliest musical memories. And my brother Mark continued on and every Jeff Beck group album, and then all the great 70s fusion stuff, The Wired and Blow by Blow. Just, wonderful, wonderful pieces of work for guitar. All part of my foundation. But when he got to Emotion and Commotion and what he was doing with the real expressive ballad kind of playing, I love Jeff because he just kept growing. He kept evolving. He never was happy to rest on his laurels. He just didn't want to repeat himself. And so that's a wonderful role model to have. So you just keep driving yourself to improve and to grow. And that's the way I feel like I've been leading my life and my career. But it's nice to have that older brother shining example, And so when he passed, it was a shock because I thought he was going to be doing it another 20 years. It just seems so sudden. And so I just felt, at least I need to honor that feeling in some way. And that's the music that came with that feeling. And then I was assembling what was becoming this record and the overall tone and an idea behind most of the songs. It felt right to open the record with that. And it leads into the second song is called Recovery, the title track.
Yeah.
And that's also another nod to Jeff in a way because it's very influenced by another track from the Emotion and Commotion record, which was a nod to Jan Hammer for them. It's called Hammerhead.
Right, okay.
Yeah. And I wanted something with that basic feel, So, yeah, that's kind of a part one and two overall as a nod to Jeff and his influence.
Nice.
But particularly from that record as he kept just evolving and I would say getting better and better,
Oh, most certainly. I mean, people will state, because we ended as lovers, as... the gold standard from Blow by Blow. And I got
cocky.
And started telling, it was like, okay, that one's great. But there's a Copacabana thing with Lee Ritenour and Steve Lukather, and that's the one that does it. But then I saw Jeff Beck do it live, and that it was a new beast beyond the blow-by-blow studio recording. Now, in the past, you recorded Beautiful Strange, also an homage to Jeff. And so, for something like this, was it a very conscious left-brain approach trying to capture that sound and feel? Or was it a case of you, Andy, settling into a certain starting point and getting Jeff into your mind's eye?
I think it's a former, because it's funny that you bring up that other song. I'd kind of forgotten the relationship, because that song, Beautiful Strange, was written after I saw Jeff for the first time in 99. And the harmony is very similar as far as the overall tonality of Beautiful Strange and Recovery. It's a dominant chord, but with a flat nine, which is a sound that Jeff and Jan Hammer used a lot in their 70s work. It just creates a mood. It's exotic in a way. It's a bit Eastern sounding. So both songs kind of are cut from that cloth a little bit, but just two different feels as far as the rhythm section goes. That's a good parallel to draw for sure. But no, it was very much, I knew I would get some of those sounds in my mind when I think of Jeff. So that's where the verses of Recovery kind of come from, with that same kind of tonality. But then I wanted it to be uplifting in a way, meaning there's kind of a darkness and a heaviness, but when the chorus kicks in, it's kind of more of an uplifting theme, you know. Then that's the theme of the record. It's healing, or something returning to its natural state, or recovering something that was lost. The basic meanings of the word recovery, or the straight up, you know, people that are recovering addicts, you know, or alcohol or drugs or internet or phone. There's a lot of addictions out there. The theme of the record kind of all encompasses that. Just things that I go through personally my entire life, whether it be depression or cancer or whatever it might be, hearing loss, so many things that each of us as human beings have to deal with. And it's all different states of recovery, and we're just kind of constantly in that state. I used to recognize that. Just now, we just finished a month of touring in Italy, and then we went to Southeast Asia, all over Japan and China, Thailand and Taiwan. So you get home, and what are you doing? You're having to recover from that, you know, 14-hour time difference and crazy schedule. There was another interview I did, and the reviewer pointed this out, and I found it to really be true, even though this was a little subconscious. But every song on the record, he was recognizing that there's usually two very different feels, meaning that there can be some very dark, brooding, contemplative sections, but there's usually some kind of light and optimism to follow. Nice. And that's really what music has always been for me, and that's part of recovering as well. I'm squeezing a lot in here to this answer, but it really does all kind of exemplify what music is for me, and I think a lot of people, where it's always been a place to heal, a place to recover, but also a place of inspiration. There's a song later on the record that's called Something Good's Gonna Come.
Yes.
And I think it's a more literal, verbal comment about the overall feeling of the record. Like, man, sometimes being dissatisfied or being down, it's good, because then there's only one place to go. You're going to recover from this. You're going to get better.
Ah.
I've recognized that in some of the darkest times or toughest times in my life, there's always something much better on the other side, even though that's hard to see in that moment. But having that optimism and having that faith are the things I think that can carry us through. Nobody gets away with not going through all this stuff. It's just kind of part of it. But that's finding that balance. Thank goodness for music is all I got to say. It's the reason you and I are sitting here talking. This means a lot to us. All the artists that we've grown up admiring and what they've given us, what they've gone through to do it. My gosh, you know? It's like,
really?
It's a lot to be thankful for. But every day, I'm thankful that myself and everybody around me that has this passion for music, we're very fortunate to have that. It's a blessing.
I'm so glad you addressed that. I was going to be asking about it anyway, because there's so many different ways that people apply this term to a variety of things. And for the tune itself, quite literally, And maybe this was the title feeding my guesswork before we spoke, but I saw it as a musical recovery or return in which you're making the statement and then you go off and you come back to the phrase, which I think may have been the basis for this tune. Speaking of which, when you do make a second or third run at this recurring phrase in recovery, it's not just a repetition, but there's this extra bend or extra stretching just a bit further. I think further, not farther. I'll have to check on that
one.
But that may be another left brain, right brain kind of thing. Was it something that came to your head initially, or to minimize repetition, you'd better maybe add that extra
that's
note?
Very interesting. I have a guitar instructional subscription site called Guitar Experience. No E before the S, guitarexperience.net. Okay. And I just got through explaining this exact thing. I recorded a tutorial for the song Recovery. So it's pretty brilliant that you point this out. That exact thing, any restatement of a melody that happens within a piece of music, you're going to have some variation. Now, it's not always a conscious, hey, I better vary this, or it's going to be like, but I think it's an inclination for things to have their own weight and their own, even if it's saying the same musical line, I want to vary it just a bit to add a little bit of interest of some way to set it off. Instead of a cut and paste, like a lot of pop music could be, that might be the same chorus every time you hear it. It's just one performance dropped in via computer. And there's nothing wrong with that. If that's the ultimate statement and that's what that artist wants to be in each section, that's great. But for me, it's, I don't know, I like that bit of variation. It could be, like you say, bending that one note a step further, which does happen in the second chorus. And then the second half of that second chorus, I then state the same melody up an octave.
Yeah.
Giving it even more energy to lift it, to keep going forward. So that's a very astute observation. I can look at it intellectually and go, that's exactly what I did. But, you know, it was more the Arlect or the instinct that got it there in the first place. And then when I do these instructional videos, I have to kind of explain it. So I'm forced to intellectualize it. But it's kind of cool to study it and recognize, oh, I see what I was doing. That makes total sense. And here we are. Talking about it also. So.
Cool to be able to step back from it in a very objective kind of way. Yeah. That's incredible, actually.
It's a lot of fun.
For this edition of KVC Arts, it's been music from and conversation with Andy Timmons, talking about a tune by, for, and with Peter Frampton, Boy from Beckenham, as well as his newest release, Recovery, just out. More at andytimmons.com and more on Recovery on the next KVC Arts. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts with thanks again to Andy Timmons. And here at KVC Art, thanks to Rick Dulock, Sandy Hodela, Zach Mays, Champ Chipman, and Shireen Awad. Many past KVC Arts can be found through iTunes, NPR One, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. And most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support. With that in mind, give any time of the year, day or night, at kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.